Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and blood's bleeding blood, man. My panelists today are...
I'm Bobinator.
I'm Kyle.
I am Satanga.
And I'm Steve Gaynor.
Oh my gosh.
Hello, everybody.
God, we've got one of those people who makes games here. How are we going to talk about games with somebody who makes them?
We'll wing it.
Believe me, it's easier than it sounds. you'll get the hang of it real quick.
On this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule two, you can nominate one game via five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. We've stopped accepting nominations via Twitter for the foreseeable future. Rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated. Just don't nominate games we've already ranked. You can see for yourself which games have been ranked on the master list. Check it out at bit.ly/47kgames. Okay, next game we're talking about is Jagged Alliance 2, which was nominated by at K2S. On Twitter. It was developed by Certec Canada, published by Talonsoft for Windows. Its earliest release date and territory is April 1999 in Europe.
Huh. Wow.
This is one of now when we found out that Steve was going to be on the show, we asked him what games that had been nominated that he would like to talk about, and this was one of them. Yeah. And so why don't you do the honors and explain how this why this game is important to you?
Sure. Jagged Alliance 2 is a, well, can we call it, it's pretty top-down, right? Or it's, Jagged Alliance 1.
Jagged Alliance, Deadly Games. It's isometric.
Yeah, it's more top-down, and then Jagged Alliance 2 is fully isometric. So it's a 2D isometric turn-based tactics game where you're controlling a squad of mercenaries that are basically trying to retake a country from like a South American country from a dictator. And so it has all these really interesting layers of it has like a business management sim to it, where you're recruiting and hiring and paying your squad of mercenaries that you like hilariously you recruit them all through basically like a simulated website. I forget what it's called. It's called like Merc.net or something, right?
No, Merc and AIM.
Yeah, there we go.
Sites.
Okay. Oh, right. Because one is that, right. Because you have like good mercs and like cheap mercs, and they're from two different sources. Yeah. You hire them.
Yeah. One of them is like a character creator, I think.
No, there's three if you include the character creator.
Oh, right. Okay. Because you create your like one main guy, right? And then everybody else you recruit. Something like
that. For the most part, there is a small, you can customize a couple of people and put them in the game if you want, but it's strictly optional.
Yeah.
So there are all these layers of like, you're hiring your mercs, you're running your business, and then you're also kind of like taking over different territories on the map of this country. And then you do that by doing really detailed turn-based tactical firefights with other squads of mercs. So it just has all these different things going on, and then each of the individual mercs that you hire has like a unique personality with their own backstory, their own voice lines, their own portrait. So it's also about juggling these personalities and these individuals who like sometimes like hate or love each other when they're on the same squad. It's a crazy game.
Yeah.
It's also very good, I think, and has a good sense of humor. It's interesting.
I just want to say I really actually like this game's concept. It's basically XCOM meets an 80s action movie, and that's an idea that is really works pretty well, I'd say.
Yeah, it's actually a fair transition. I was going to say that we reviewed XCOM ourselves not too long ago, and I was wondering how much parody could be brought between those two games. I mean, it certainly, would you say that Jagged Alliance 2 is a little more accommodating? Like, it doesn't have as many layers to follow as XCOM does, so it's easier to follow, and I think easier to get into starting off the bat. I wouldn't go so far as to call it easier to get into off the bat,
because you have, when you open the game, it's like, here's the merc interface, here's the strategic thing, here's the huge area that you have to manage.
To be fair, I did spend a lot of time not actually putting my mercs out in the field. I just had fun dicking around on the pre-millennium internet. The interface on that is just so, like, dedicated and authentic to how computers actually looked back then. But I probably farted around a lot more than you guys played it seriously. But I still had fun with it. Don't get me wrong. I mean,
I kind of... The one thing I kept looking for was like some other like indicia of like late 90s internet, like the little like working like web page in progress guy, like doing the shovel.
Right.
You know, if they had that, it'd be perfect. It's hard to say a game that starts you out in a simulated computer desktop is easy to get going. But it does. I figured it out. I didn't look at the manual when I picked it up again. So I was able to get going.
You know, no, JA2, I mean, you know, whether or not compared to XCOM, at least compared to other strategy games, it is very much a simplified interface, and I had no problems navigating the menus and guiding everybody around anywhere, and I really like how when you're not fighting, everyone just walks in tandem across the maps, which instead of having to individually pick everybody, I mean, you know, it's a relatively small but appreciable feature.
Well, that feature is why the game had kind of come in as some people, or it had been billed as an RPG, which did it a huge disservice, because people were picking this up in 1999, like, I'm getting an RPG, and no, they really, no, help them.
It does kind of resemble Fallout in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
The combat reminds me a lot of Fallout, with the way you have, like, action points and ways you can target different parts on an enemy. It's very similar, I'd say.
Yeah, except the item, like, the way that you, like, equip your character is downright granular. I say detailed as an understatement. Like when I was learning how to, like, okay, so I've got a medic on my team, right? And this is really important to have one of these people. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, so I've got a guy who's been, like, shot in the belly or something. He's bleeding out. I need to heal him, patch him up. I've got the medic. I open their inventory. They've got a first aid kit. Like, okay, what do I do? Do I drag it onto the guy? No. Okay, that's not it. No, that's not it. You got to remove the gun from their hand, put it back in their inventory, and then put the first aid kit in that hand, and then have them touch the person. And it's not, I mean, once you get used to it, it's not that crazy, but, you know, it's like, that's a level of work involved in doing something that most games would not bother with.
I feel like when you mentioned that it came out in 99, I was actually surprised, because I would have thought, like, in my head, it was slightly earlier. I think some of that is that it feels of a slightly earlier era. And I mean, that makes sense since it's a direct sequel to a game from like 95 or 96 or whatever. But I think it has that it's in that strange middle ground of being, of having the feel and a lot of the maybe lack of kind of accessibility polish of like an early to mid 90s PC game. But kind of the expanded, you know, feature set and complexity of a later game, because it does expect a lot out of you. It does expect a lot out of, like, you're just like juggling all these different aspects of having a successful squad and then turning that into a successful, like, territory control campaign for this entire country.
It's not dissimilar from XCOM in that it's kind of like, well, we don't expect you to probably easily beat the game the first time, because you're probably going to do something wrong. Your mercs, you're going to lose a bunch of mercs, and then they'll be like, well, I don't want to be hired by you. You killed all these people, because they will actually do that. You kill enough people, and they'll be like, nope, not going to have anything to do with you. You're Mr. Gets Everyone Killed.
Wow. Oh, because you've, like, lost so many mercs, they're like, I'm not signing up for this death,
one thing
death wish, this suicide
yeah,
wish.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do.
Wow.
One thing that's interesting about this game compared to XCOM is, I don't think you get, like, an unlimited number of guys. I don't know what happens if you run out of people you can hire, but since they're all unique, you only have, like, about, like, 20 to 30 guys that you can hire from the start.
I think that total, there's like, I don't know how many, I think there's more than, I feel like in Jagged Alliance 2, there's closer to like 50 or 60 individuals total, but maybe I'm wrong.
They're divided between the AIM people, the Merc people, and you get a handful of characters in the game map too.
Right, that you can actually like rescue or recruit or whatever, like in a map.
Yeah, who are free and they don't charge you money per day.
Yeah.
To operate, which is nice. And that's like cool about the game is I don't know if we mentioned that the strategic map that you take control of this micro country from, once you interact with that, you can do things like train people and repair stuff on this screen, which is very, I guess, kind of Fallout-y, and that it's a time lapse kind of deal where you move between places. But what you also get is if you have to take over mines to generate money, you can take the airports that you can actually dispatch your guys to different places easier. There's this kind of like actual sense that what you're doing in the world map and is connected to what you're doing in the sort of small maps. It's not a series of disconnected skirmishes and then you win the game. There's like a little bit more going on, which is cool.
Yeah, because you don't just want to like take over all the territory. You want to like take over an airfield because it's going to like have a specific effect on the dictatorship and like what you have access to.
I would say it's a lot like the Geoscape of XCOM, just a lot smaller in scale because you're only dealing with one particular country.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the cool thing is that the Geoscape is, as anyone knows, is completely randomized in the sense that you go to a square and it's, you know, whatever. They just generate, it's a farm, it's a city, we don't care. It's that place. In Jagged Alliance, it's actually Jagged Alliance 2, I believe each square is not generated in any way. Every square is sort of handcrafted and you just zoom into that square when an action occurs, which is pretty cool for giving a sense of place to the whole experience.
So
yeah, and then what can be different is like which faction is in control of it and what like the loadout of enemies and civilians are in each one. But yeah, the environment is baked in every time.
One thing that struck me about this game that was interesting is how much, like, especially early in the game, like travel and travel time and plays into your strategy. That was the thing that kept getting me is like, I have to, like, for instance, like if you don't have an airfield, I think, right, if you need to hire somebody new, you have to have them like land wherever they can and then they catch up.
Yeah.
And
they basically have to like walk there.
Yeah.
And you can do things like go on the road, but the road is dangerous because there's more patrols on the road, so you actually can go through the countryside. So it really does push this actual sort of guerrilla-ness to your endeavors.
Could you say that is almost comparable to Fallout because it has a consistent map running to it as well? Like, I hate to keep comparing this game to XCOM, but it is like XCOM plus Fallout, and it's definitely nothing against it. I mean, I think this is a game that really has taken its influences into check and has refined them into something that I think might be a little easier for general audiences to play. I mean, you know, you still have the stuff like the equipping and whatnot, but I don't know, I still found the interface easier to pick up with than I thought it would have been, because usually most strategy games I find too Byzantine for my little mind.
So we have a rare opportunity here because Steve actually makes games and knows what it takes to make a game, whereas we just talk about them as if we know, like, oh, they could have done better with this. Oh, this design choice is terrible. But we were talking about how, like, the level of detail and complexity that doesn't always, it kind of, in a way, almost takes away from the gaminess of it in a sense. Yeah. That can't be something that, they did more work to make that possible, right? Like that has to be. What kind of decisions? Like, how does that decision making process work? You're like, we really want to have this level of, I don't know what else to call it, but minutia for the player to do to do a simple task.
I think a lot of it just comes out of like in a game like Jagged Alliance 2. My expectation, and a lot of it is just like coming from the point of view of we want to like. To emphasize what's interesting or cool about the tactical aspect of our game or about the, you know, decisions you make outside of combat and how they affect combat, like, we want to have this feature in there. Like, we want to be able to have you, like, put weapon mods on guns or, like, put, you know, like, a silencer on a rifle and then take it off during combat and have that affect, you know, stats and how enemies react and all that kind of stuff. And, like, I feel like then once you've decided we do want to support this feature that's like a high detail kind of feature, then it becomes the real design problem work of like, okay, well, we already have this entire other interface. We have this whole other game that's already set up that either can't change or can't change that much or that defines how the player, you know, expects to interact with stuff. So if we want to have you be able to, you know, whatever, put on weapon mods in combat or something, like, how do we make that an aspect of our existing interface that we like can't get away from in some ways? And I think that, you know, in a lot of cases that can mean like, okay, well, the specific method of doing this thing is not super intuitive or is kind of buried or is like a weird subset of what you would already normally do. But like, it's the only way that we could put this idea on screen and also like ship the game. You know what I mean? So seeing how those things get kind of like, they kind of like get wedged in somehow. But then like, you know, the design team deciding it's more important that we do have this feature, even if it's maybe kind of like awkward or not initially super clear how to interface with it, is like more valuable than not having it. And seeing how that plays out can be really interesting in any game that you play, you know?
Yeah. I get the feeling that they must have known at a certain point that they got a pretty damn good game here on their hands.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know what? Anybody who's going to get something out of this game and really enjoy it the way they were probably enjoying it, the developers would probably be willing to tolerate a little bit of roughness or obtuseness in certain aspects of the game if it allows for all this other customization.
Yeah. Well, there's this idea of like expert features where it's sort of like, it's always that balance of if there's something that a lot of players might miss, but it's okay if you never actually interface with it. It just like gives you a little deeper, you know, relationship with the game, but it's not like you're going to totally fail if you don't understand how to do this thing. Then it can kind of be okay for it to be, you know, less accessible in that way. And I feel like that's especially like in the present day that's almost like the defining design outlook for a lot of games, where it's just like, how do you know how to do all the crafting in Minecraft? Like, open up the wiki.
I don't think a human being figured those out.
No, I don't. I mean, a lot of human beings did online together.
So,
but like, yeah, that was what the like 120 page manuals were for back in the day.
Right? Yeah, I do feel like there's a lot of things that aren't like really clear to the player. Like, say, knowing, you don't ever really know if your shots are very accurate or if there's anything affecting your shots.
Oh, yeah, you're supposed to kind of just figure that out. Like, you just sort of look, you're supposed to just play the game enough that you kind of go, oh, I think that's blocking my, it's fine, I'll work it out. Like,
I do want to say real quick, though, that this game actually does have, like, a little help menu, and that's something that you don't really see in games of that era very often. That's kind of nice to have.
Yeah,
it is nice.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't have to do in so much targeting, but sorry for one more XCOM comparison, but did anyone else experience the sort of XCOMian way of shooting at someone from like two steps away and still missing? Because is that just something that's endemic to games like these, or is it like...
I think an interesting part about this one specifically is this game's kind of realistic. They're willing to throw out the realism when it's not going to make for a fun game, which I think is really important for this one. But, well, you know, they're kind of like, well, a person can miss at close range because they can miss. And they're just like, that's just how it works, you know?
Yeah, no, I got you.
Yeah, the turn-basedness of it makes that a little bit more frustrating because for the player, everything stops. But ostensibly, in the game world, it's not like that. It's happening in real time in the story, which is something we probably don't have time to get into. I will say that in terms of realism, I don't think I played a game that is this wrapped up in like firearms and other stuff that I don't really know much about since like the first, you know, the original Wasteland.
Yeah.
Had, like, all the different ammo types and stuff that you could really trip you up.
If you're somebody who's into guns, this is going to be a good game for you. I'm not, but I'm sure somebody would really appreciate
this. It's got fantastic gun sound effects. Just, they recorded so many, and in high quality, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, this game's sound design on the whole is really enjoyable, and I actually found out, off note, that the composer Kevin Manthey was also the composer for Invader Zim, one of my show's favorite shows, so he's done a good deal of stuff. I thought it would have been Frank Klepacki at first, but... I mean, no, the sound design is just really well done on the whole. And I don't want to consume too much other time, but there is one thing I wanted to ask Steve about. Do you prefer to play the game as it is, or do you employ the 1.13 fan patch that a lot of people really like to play for this game that ostensibly improves all its features?
So the last time I actually played Jagged Alliance 2 was like quite some time ago, but I think the last time I played it, I actually did use the fan patch. And I think that I did enjoy it. I liked the like extra interesting features that it added. Some of them are like usability features, and some of them are like more like geeky details about, you know, yeah, like the guns and stuff. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they added in some features like, if you don't suppress airfields, then there can be like airstrikes during battles and stuff that didn't happen in the main game and stuff like that.
The one thing I know for sure is I believe it added back in and properly implemented suppressing fire, which I don't think is in the basic game, but in the fan patch, when you shoot towards enemies, even if you miss, they get movement penalties and stuff, which is probably a solid improvement for anyone who's really concerned about that whole, oh, they miss at close range. Well, now you can actually pin people down, and it meaningfully impacts their ability to perform
action. I do have one complaint about the patch for me personally. I don't know what it is, but I didn't get this game to run very well on my Windows 10 computer. If I played the GOG version unpatched, it worked, but the frame rate was kind of stuttery and not entirely comfortable. And when I tried the 1.13 patch, the game just didn't work at all. So maybe that's just my fault for sticking with Windows 10. I don't know.
I think GOG's still... before they've been doing good with future-proofing things, but since 10, it seems like things haven't been as reliable. I mean, I'm still running 7 because I'm afraid of the future of technology. I have had no problems running it on 7, so...
But it's not Jagged Alliance's fault that you're trying to run it on an operating system decades after its release.
That's the failure of not future-proofing stuff that every game in the 90s on computers had, so...
Yeah, so we got to rank this soon, but before we do, Steve, if you don't mind, I just want to ask one more question. So this game, as you mentioned, has... a lot of, you know, voice samples and character interactions for all these like little, you know, seemingly insignificant characters. There's like, you know, somewhere between 30 and 60 characters.
Yeah.
And, but there's a lot of, I feel like a lot of their personality comes out in these very, very tiny interactions. I was curious whether that was one of the things that stood out to you because, you know, the games you've worked on, and most recently being Gone Home is a lot of stuff where it's like, how much personality and backstory and information can we communicate with very little visual or auditory information?
Through voice stuff. I mean, that was definitely something that I wanted to mention before we moved off of Jagged Alliance 2, is I thought that XCOM and other tactical, and like, it's a real-time game, but like Syndicate is another one of my, like, one of the kind of isometric PC games from that era that I really liked. But like, you know, the people you're controlling, they have their individual stats and loadouts and stuff like that. But aside from maybe like in XCOM, you know, giving your character like a specific name or something, they aren't really deeply individualized. And the fact that in Jagged Alliance 2, you were choosing characters based on their stats, but also based on like who they were as like fictional characters and how they talked and like what their personality was. And then that looped back around into like the stats and effectiveness side, because there would be characters that like these two characters hate each other. And if you put them on the same squad, their morale is going to go down until one of them just like quits and you lose them as a squad member. Or like, I remember, I think it's in Jagged Alliance 2. It might've been in Jagged Alliance Deadly Games, but there's like, a male and female merc, and they're married, and if you put them on the same squad, their morale goes up super high, but if either of them dies, the other one just like flips out and quits immediately. And so like that kind of stuff is amazing because like you have their individual personalities and then how they like overlap and affect your squad, and that stuff I thought was like super unique and really well thought out and just kind of entertaining and strange and cool to encounter.
Yeah, wasn't the same couple divorced in two and they actually don't they hate each other if you put them on the same team? I mean, I remember hearing, I know there's a divorced couple in two and for like one of their profiles, they outright tell you, do not put these people together or else you will lose. Yeah, that is a neat feature. I almost wish there'd be a little more foreshadowing as to who does work and do not, but, you know, it's part of the game's experimentation, and I still do find a unique punch of personality that just fleshes out the context of the game that much more, so it is neat in that sense.
And there are those, they're like, if I remember, there are even moments where, like, if you have two characters that like each other on the squad and one of them like kills an enemy, the other one will have their portrait pop up and be like, nice shot. Just like that kind of stuff just added so much to the feeling of these being like specific people that you were kind of invested in. So
what personality do you usually get out of these strategy games? Almost like paving the way for Fire Emblem, which, Fire Emblem existed while Jagged Alliance did, but not in the States yet. So, but yeah, you get what I mean.
But yeah, I was about to say some of these are
dialogue there, kind of conceptually. Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say some of these are almost like dating sim elements that if there's one game genre that I feel like needs to be folded over or melded with other game genres more often, it's dating sims. Like I want a dating sim dungeon crawler. I want a dating sim like trivia game. I want, you know, like
speak Japanese because there's like 300 of them.
Sorry. No.
I want to make one more point before I forget. I brought this up to Zerzi, and I think he'll agree. This is like our most Dogs of Valor game, because Dogs would be all over this if he were in this game.
Would. I feel like him and Blood would get along great. I liked Blood a lot.
I do want to add to something that's interesting is that this game has a lot of negative effects that occur when you have mercs mixing together compared to something like Fire Emblem, where it's nothing but positive. No one in Fire Emblem, your characters that join up and hate each other. They all like, yeah, I can gain abilities with them, but this Fire game Emblem, takes a different approach.
I want to say this is going to sound crazy, but Japanese games, like Japanese society is so teamwork oriented. And like, if you don't like somebody and you have to work with them, like tough, like suck it up, like don't mention it to anybody. I think it's almost, it would be might be more frustrating to those players to have that, but let's go ahead and get into ranking this and we'll try to make this quick. Sure. I don't know. I don't want to be the first one to pitch a spot because this is the first time I played a Jagged Alliance game in like 10 years, maybe or more. And I'm like kind of hooked on it right now. So my opinion might be biased a little bit. So somebody else, give it a shot.
My starting point is like, in my head, is just like what it can't be above. And going through the list, I'm sort of like, okay, it can't, for me personally, it can't be above Full Throttle. Because I'm looking at Full Throttle at 55, and I'm like, it's not better than that. And I'm going further down the list, and I'm not seeing anything that jumps out at me instantly. It's just like, oh yeah, it has to be under that. So my starting point personally would be like, 56 or 57.
That's pretty low, especially compared to XCOM. Can I ask why you'd put it that low?
It's mostly just because in my own personal list of games, I'm like, okay, so for people who aren't looking at the list, 52 is God Hand, 53 is Shenmue, 54 is Bushido Blade, 55 is Full Throttle. And I'm like, all of those are extremely powerful games to me, and I wouldn't put JA2 above any of those, but I could put them right after.
Well, see,
I guess one of the problems we've got here is, sorry, just real quick, is that we've hit a density in the top half of our list where just almost every game there is like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, right. Well, it's going to a problem that we'll be encountering a good deal more down the road. But,
I don't know. I still get complaints almost on a weekly basis about how high Blue Stinger is, but I don't care.
There is no other game like it. We
put those complaints in the trash where they belong.
I have a piece of advice for Steve. We almost always compare every single game we ever do to UN Squadron for some reason I can't figure out.
Right.
So
it's like the fighter jet version of like Gradius kind of, right? Like
Essentially.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it keeps coming up to that comparison, but that's usually a safe place around where to rank games. We're not sure where we can rank them.
I definitely put Jagged Alliance 2 above UN Squadron.
Okay. I would put
Jagged Alliance 2 above Full Throttle, and I'll tell you why. It's because Full Throttle, as great as it is, it's the artwork. The art direction is fantastic. The voice acting is fantastic.
Yes.
First in class. And those are definitely where they should be considering what had come before it. But, and the question I like to ask a lot, is it better enough than, say, like Monkey Island and other stuff that predates it as an adventure game? And I don't know whether it really, I always felt like as an adventure game, Full Throttle was a little bit lacking. Everything else about the game, but not that.
I like the straightforwardness of most of the puzzles in Full Throttle, but it is a little, like, it doesn't have as many surprisingly weird puzzles, and it does have some stumpers that aren't super, like, satisfying to get through. But, like, everything else that surrounds it makes it really, like, important to me. But it's also, it's subjective on that level. It would be my favorite of that era, but I wouldn't be able to say, like, well, objectively, it's obviously better than Monkey Island 2 or, whatever, right? Because they are also very different. So
yeah, you're in luck. This is technically, like, we pretend to be objective, but it's really kind of arbitrary. So, but that's why I would put it. I would put it above. As much as I love Bushido Blade, I would put it above Bushido Blade, below. Well, I would put
Shenmue
it.
Shenmue is ambitious enough to maybe hold its place. Maybe.
Between Shenmue and Bushido Blade is what we're leaning towards here?
I could see that. Within this list, I could see that being.
Yeah. There's a lot of great games that are not on the list yet.
Yeah. So.
I think personally that would be a good placement. I mean, normally I'm not too big on strategy games because I find them way too complex and my brain works like a dinosaur's. It's very pea-brained but very reactive-based, more or less. But as far as strategy games go, JA2 is really top quality. I just really couldn't find a lot of faults with it. It just felt like the most refined product of its time, and for a while to come down the line, I'd say that no other game quite matched up to the sort of polish that it had. So, yeah, I think this is a good place for any to rank it. Between Shenmue and Bushido Blade, unless anyone else has any further comments?
Doesn't matter, they're outvoted.
Okay, fair enough.
It is done.
All right.
Okay, our next game we're talking about is Super Metroid. Maybe you've heard of it. It was nominated by @HoosierDaveZero and @Resonance333 on Twitter. It was developed by Nintendo R&D1 and Intelligent Systems. I didn't know Intelligent Systems was involved. We're just talking about Fire Emblem, right? And it was published by Nintendo for the Super Nintendo. Earliest release date is March 19th, 1994 in Japan. Where the hell do we start with Super Metroid? We can probably skip a lot of the basic stuff because everybody knows about this game.
Yeah. And we would have covered some of it when we talked about Metroid, so you can go check out that one as well if you didn't for some reason, because we already covered the basics.
Super Metroid was one of those, like, extremely classic Super Nintendo games that I did not actually really play very much of when it came out. And I had a Super Nintendo. I played a good deal of stuff. And I played the original Metroid on NES when I was a kid. But Super Metroid was one of those games that that wasn't one of the games that I played through when I was that age. And then later on, I knew it as one of these really crucial games. And I think I like played a little bit of it on an emulator, and it never really clicked with me. And then finally, I played all the way through Super Metroid on the Wii Virtual Console.
Ooh.
When I was working on Bioshock 2, because I was the lead designer on Minerva's Den, which was the story DLC for that game. And the first level, especially, of Minerva's Den was very much structured around, like, Metroid-esque, like, it's, you know, an open, like, layout, but different parts of the map are locked off by you getting player abilities. And so I was, like, going back, and I played the original System Shock, and I played Super Metroid. And those are the two things that I, like, played for research when I was working on Minerva's Den, because it's such a good example. It's sort of, like, the standard setter, along with the original Metroid, but I think it really refined it, of the idea that there's one huge interconnected map, and the only thing that's keeping you from exploring all of it is getting these different abilities that allow you to traverse the environment differently or open up you know, gates differently, but also each of those abilities is like a combat ability that lets you deal with enemies in different ways. And just the way all that stuff interlocks is super compelling and really, really well done, especially for it being, you know, released in the first half of the 90s. It just feels like such a beautifully designed game.
So since this had a direct impact, I mean, I've talked to more than one game developer about Super Metroid, and everybody seems to have their own, like, moment in the game that was the thing that not necessarily clicked with them, but said, like, oh, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to have. What was that moment for you, if there was one, and how did, what were the results of that? What did it inspire?
So, you know, when working on, like, a Bioshock game, there's only so much, like, you've got plasmids and weapons, and, like, in Bioshock 2, we had a hack tool. So, like, you kind of have your palette, but in the DLC, we were able to make a new plasmid and a new weapon. The weapon just did, like, direct damage, but the new plasmid, we were like, what do we want to do with this new plasmid? And we wanted to make something specifically that could be useful in combat, but also we could figure out a way to let you unlock doors with it. And so, you know, that was really inspired by stuff like, I mean, there's a lot of things that let you open new parts of the world in Super Metroid, but some of them are classic Metroid-y things, like, you know, you get missiles and now you can shoot missile doors open, and like, you know, that's just really, it's a missile that's all, it's like an attack that's also a key card. But then the really impressive stuff that's, like, cool and inspiring is when you get the freeze ray, and then you can freeze the enemies that go back and forth, and you turn enemies into platforms so you can jump up to a higher area that you couldn't reach otherwise. And you're like, oh, this freeze ray is super valuable as a combat tool. And now these enemies that I've been seeing for hours, I think of them differently, and I affect them in a way that lets me access different areas. And that's, like, the stuff. When you're a designer, you're like, ah, that's the stuff. That's really smart, you know? And it clicks. Nobody has to tell you, you should freeze those guys so you can jump up there. You just do it, and you're like, oh, now I can get up there. And so for us, when we put the plasmid in Minerva's Den, it was called the Gravity Well plasmid, which in combat, it, like, sucks enemies into a central point to kind of, like, crowd control enemies and then does damage to them. But you throw it like a grenade, and so there are these doors that you basically throw the plasmid up over a barrier, and then it uses the suction to, like, pull out these, like, electromagnets, basically, to open doors. And so it's one thing that affects the enemies and the environment in different ways to basically, you know, let you kind of understand the world differently. And that's the kind of stuff in a game like Metroid that's just, like, really, really cool and satisfying as a player to just, like, be able to observe and then use that tool in an intuitive way that, you know, lets you kind of experience the entirety of the game, which is awesome.
Yeah, I think there's, like, an interesting, there's something that the first three Metroid games do really well that I always love when I see it in another game, which is what you just described, where you've got a new ability that has more than one function, and you kind of discover them sort of organically, like, in the process of playing. One of the most satisfying things to me as a person who plays way too many games is when I play a game and I feel like I figured something out, like, that, oh, I'm clever. Like, I can do this. I'm going to do this. Now I'm going to go here. Now I'm going to go there. I've got these ideas start popping. And although that's by design, Like, it's not like I'm really figuring anything out. I'm doing exactly what the developers wanted me to do. But it feels so satisfying because it feels like I'm really using my brain and imposing my will on this hostile environment. That to me is a big deal.
Yeah, because it's all set up by the designers, but it's being activated by your own powers of observation, right? Like, they're not saying, like, now go do this, but you're like, oh, wait, now where else did I see those enemies? Where else can I use this ability? And you're making those connections, which, you know, like, even if the designers, like, put them there for you to make, you are still making them in an organic way, which is super satisfying as a player.
Yeah, the whole design of the levels of Super Metroid, I think, is probably the best quality of the game and probably the best aged component in that it doesn't really matter what generation of games you're coming from. It's so well funneled in how it throws you into place and says, well, go this way. No, actually, that way is the only way you're going to actually be able to go. And then eventually you'll bounce around, get the power up you need and go, oh, right, I can go to that other place. So it kind of bounces you from funnel to funnel, but it never rarely feels like you're being railroaded, which I think is really key to the game's design.
Yeah, right. Definitely. Super Metroid feels like it provides a good balance between exploration but structure so that you don't get too terribly lost. Like, unless you do some, like, glitching and sequence breaking, you're not accidentally going to end up in the wrecked ship like the instant you touch down on the planet.
Right.
There is definitely a bit of a structure, almost level-like, but nonetheless, it's not so on the rails that, I mean, compared to the original Metroid, I do think that Super Metroid does a better job of telling you where to go. Some may also argue, though, that compared to the original Metroid, this also makes the game feel a little more sterile in a way. I mean, I wouldn't complain about that, but Callan Xerxes might, because, Steve, we have an unfortunate shocker for you, because Callan Xerxes are not the biggest fans of Super Metroid, and we're going to have an actual argument on this show about that.
We'll get to that, but
I'm selling them out for our guests.
Screaming. Going wild.
I have played Super Metroid. I actually used to own it. It's just, I must have been at that point in my life where I wasn't very good at games. I never made it too far. I know I at least made the Zibbies. If I had to guess, I probably got stuck at that point where you have to dash and the game doesn't explain that very well. That's one complaint I do have about the game. It doesn't always explain things very well.
How does it explain the dash mechanic? Is it one of the creatures that shows you what to do?
It's like a really fast bird, I think, that runs back and forth.
Yeah,
yeah.
I will say probably the worst thing about Super Metroid is that the wall jump mechanic tuning is like super hard to pull off.
Yeah, in
a way it doesn't really need to be.
You're almost not required to unless you fall down the pit with the three little aliens that show you how to do that, but. Yeah, as a kid, I think I, like, gave up on that point and just, like, restarted and then never fell down there, so that's one way to get around it.
I think a component is that the game doesn't have, and Metroid was really bad about this, Super Metroid has a little bit element of it, there's no ultimate fallback if a player just keeps not being able to figure out a solution or a situation. Like, the game's never going to outright, like, something like Shadow of the Colossus eventually just says, all right, I don't care. This is how you beat the boss. Just do it. I'm sick of you mucking around.
That didn't help for Colossus 12, but go on.
Yeah, but whereas Super Metroid, if you get stuck, if you somehow miss the game's throwing little breadcrumbs at you, at some point you're gonna be like, oh, I don't know. I have to get someone to tell me because I'm screwed.
I have to send in $9.99 for the official Nintendo Power Strategy Guide for this. Yeah.
Order today, man.
Either call the hotline when your parents aren't around.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
yeah. They'll get the phone bill, and then you will get, you know.
I miss that feature.
I guess one thing about Super Metroid is when you're talking about how it does a very good job of showing you, mostly does a good job of showing you rather than telling you where to go, which is a problem that a lot of people had with its sequel, Metroid Fusion, which has a kind of telling you where to go, where it just shows you like a, here's like a follow the big ass square to the thing, you know. But I would say that this it's very much, it's not so, it's kind of hits that sweet spot, because Metroid 2, remember, had the earthquake thing. So it was super linear in a sense, because it, every time you got to another area, that was the limit of where you could go. And once you beat the last Metroid in that area, then there would be an earthquake, and then the lava would recede, and you could go further into the, deeper into the planet. Which to me doesn't, I mean, playing, I can still play Metroid 2 now and still feel good about it. The only thing I want to say about Super Metroid is that, to me, when I played it as a kid, because I had played so much of the first two Metroids, it felt a little bit easy and hand-holdy, because and one good and bad thing about it, depending on how you look at it, is that every room in the game is different. It's unique. Whereas with the original Metroid, they couldn't do that, of course. There were technical limitations, but they kind of worked around that, where it's supposed to be disorienting and weird and kind of, you're supposed to get lost in it. And the problem with the original Metroid is its tells weren't very good. Like, there's a way of knowing...
And how.
Yeah, there's a way of knowing which walls you can bomb through, but I've like, this happened recently where I posted a couple pictures on Twitter and just said that this is what I was talking about when I was talking about how you tell. And I had like 10 people respond, like, I don't get it. I don't see it. And right. It is kind of weird. Like, you can't see it until you see it. It's like those old magic eye things. You know?
Right. Yeah. It's
stupid.
Hey, don't call magic eyes stupid. They're kick ass.
They are pretty okay, great, sorry. But.
I agree that they're good. So I think that, yeah, we should get to the ranking. I would rank Magic Eye Pictures probably like
Magic Eyes are
above UN Squadron.
Well, you can stick the page in your face. There's two different ways to approach them. They're really interesting.
I think that something that in the best cases, the thing that's cool about getting like a gating power like that, like, you know, yeah, when you get a new power up and it lets you enter a new area, is that the power itself is like communicating something indirectly but clearly, where it's not like, you're not like, well, I have this new power, I guess I'll wander around until I figure out how to use it. You like get the new power and you're like, oh, that means I should go back to this place I was at before. And that's like really exciting, and it's a super like elegant way for a designer to tell you where to go next without telling you where, which is, you know, in like a much, much more kind of mundane way, was what we wanted to do, like with the house in Gone Home, where it's like, we don't say you should go to the basement now because that's your objective. But when you get a basement key and you've been, like, you've been near the locked basement door before, and you're like, oh shit, I have the key now, I should go down there. You know, like, you're telling yourself that via really clear, you know, like, cues from the designer, but that feeling of just saying, like, I got the thing, and now I'm excited to go there because I want to, you know, and that can be right. Something like the freeze beam or super missiles or, you know, whatever. That just that moment of like realization, I think is really exciting when you run into it.
Yeah. As a game designer, I'd imagine it's very challenging to come up with ways of doing that, because the bigger space you have to work now, Gone Home takes place within a house, but as we talked about, there's a lot of stuff to see and do in the house, but with a game like Super Metroid, right, it's a very big world, and that's a lot of stuff, because in order to know what to anticipate what the player is going to do, you have to know that world backwards and forwards, and that's got to be hard because you're building it as you go.
Yeah, no, I mean, looking at Super Metroid as a piece, as like a final piece, just makes it that much more, it kind of impressive to think like, man, they had to really make sure all of this stuff lined up all the way throughout development. And knowing how game development goes, yeah, it's not like you draw your perfect world map and then you just put it in the game, right? So like juggling all that stuff to turn it into the game it ended up being is just one more thing about Super Metroid that is just really kind of incredible.
Now your next game, I'm very curious how much perhaps unintentional parallels to Metroid Fusion we're going to see, because Metroid Fusion is one of those games where the computer might be up to some mischief. And it kind of plays with your
computers, say.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, but Fusion, one thing I like about Fusion, because I'm gonna segue into ranking Super Metroid, and the reason why I although I wouldn't recommend somebody play Fusion first, the reason why I like Fusion and go back to it more than Super Metroid is because I feel like Fusion is doing something. It's playing with the one of the big criticisms, as I said, is that it kind of directs the player where to go. It'll show you need to go here, but it doesn't tell you how to get there. And so the game, as the worlds progress, it starts like it gets harder and harder to get to where that giant ass flashing square is. And you have to start kind of, you feel like you're breaking the rules of the space station that you're in. And then as you get toward the last third of the game, and you're really breaking the rules because you can like find secret passages between the different biomes or environments or whatever they're called. And then that's when you start learning that the computer, the artificial intelligence thing in the space station is not trustworthy. And then it's hand-holding stuff becomes like a live, like, wait, what? Can I trust this thing? Am I supposed to do this? So you don't have to give up any secrets. I don't, you know, I'm not asking that, but I'm just saying, like, I'll
be curious. No spoilers.
And I'm not saying that you were playing Metroid, or that I don't know that you've ever played that game, but it will be interesting.
The first GBA one, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, I have played that. Is that the one that there's a clone of?
Yeah,
Samus?
Yeah, the SAX is it's known as. I do think Fusion's really good and underrated, and I recommend anyone who really likes Super go play it, because... Yeah, I don't think there's actually too much from it that's too far removed from Super, aside from its structure, but it does have a very interesting feel about it that no other Metroid is quite encapsulated.
I played all the way through that. That's one of the only other Metroid games I've actually like completed all the way through. I remember liking it a lot. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, in that case, I guess we should get down to ranking this one, and... I'm going to rank it as high as Steve wants to like it. I'm sorry to sound sycophantic here, but I know behind the scenes, I was arguing a lot with Cal yesterday about where Super Metroid should ultimately go, because I'm like, you're not going to rank this below the original Metroid, are you guys?
You're damn right.
Oh,
no. I'm curious why you feel that way, honestly.
So from my perspective, I wouldn't. But okay, so I'm looking at the list again. Let me ask you guys a question. What the hell is Load Runner Online, The Mad Monk's Revenge?
Load Runner.
It's a beautifully amazing game that I'm like... I mean, I know what Load Runner is.
Mad Monk's Revenge is kind of like a sequel slash remake to the original Apple game. Adds in a lot of features. We really enjoyed it when we talked about it.
I'm a big fan of... I'll just say this because it gives me a chance to just give a shout out to the late, great Doug Smith, who designed the original Load Runner. This is the only Load Runner. There have been so many versions of Load Runner that come out since, and they're all worse than the original, except this one. And this one, it's an example, and this is fitting because we're talking about Super Metroid here. And the question about Super Metroid, I think, ultimately is it, as I said before, is it better enough?
Yeah.
It's built on what came before it. Is it better enough? And that's the same thing with Load Runner Online. Is it better enough than Load Runner? And that's an example of a game that... I would say, yeah, it is. It has the sticky floors. It's got it plays around with the AI of the enemies as a puzzle in a way. And that is why, although I don't like Super Metroid better than the original Metroid, I'm a diehard, dyed-in-the-wool Metroid fan. That was my favorite game when I was a kid. But I would rank Super Metroid higher in terms of...
Okay, good. So you don't have any problem then.
Well, but how high? That's the problem.
Definitely.
I mean, because I do think that it's important, because we do have on the list another example in the same area from the same damn company of a game that does take a step further than its predecessor. And that is, of course, A Link to the Past, which is up there at number 5. And as far as I'm concerned, Link to the Past is a much better Zelda game plus one than Super Metroid is to Metroid. Because I feel like Super Metroid has got a coat of paint and it smooths out the gameplay a bit, but it just doesn't feel like it's as huge a step. I mean, most of the abilities, like, the ice weapons and a lot of those are in Metroid and they're not really tangibly different, which is fine.
It's true
I wouldn't
put... I'd say that it's true that most of the things that Super Metroid improves on are largely qualitative. Like there are a number of new ideas, but the stuff that's better about it is, I think, more on the like execution level than the like all these new amazing innovations. And so I think the things that are better about it are execution on basically all levels, where some of it is tech, but some of it is like, you know, more refined design. It has, you know, better visuals, which only some aspects of that are because it's on an SNES. But also it does have, I think, an interesting kind of parallel to Link to the Past, because it also plays on that interesting, like, recent nostalgia, where it, you know, is revisiting some areas and concepts from the original Metroid, but through the lens of having played with them before in like a knowing way, which is, I think, really cool and interesting, especially for that, you know, for 1994.
Right. And with it, it tells a story, right? Like it kind of, like when you go back into the game in Super Metroid, you go back into like, you know, at the end of the original Metroid, a bomb goes off and it destroys the complex or whatever. Then you can go back down in reverse in Super Metroid. And that to me, when I was a kid, was the most affecting thing I'd ever seen in a game. Yeah. That's like, it was so, because I was such, like I said, I was the only kid in my neighborhood that liked Metroid at all. But yeah.
Can I tell you a really quick side story about when the original Metroid? So like I'm 34, so I was born in the very early 80s. So like when Metroid, when NES, you know, when the core NES games were coming out, I was still pretty young, and I didn't really have the skill or kind of like the mental perspective to really be able to like beat most NES games that I liked. You know, I got like a good way through Super Mario Brothers or Super Mario Brothers 2 or Metroid or Punch-Out or whatever. But like the cool thing for me was, and this is, I'm probably not the only person who had this experience, but I got to see the end of Metroid and the end of Super Mario Brothers 2 and the end of Punch-Out and stuff in the era before YouTube, because I had a teenage babysitter who would come over and play through the games to the end. And so I could watch. So I saw like the Metroid like swimsuit ending on an NES in whatever 1987. Because my babysitter was like that good that he could clear the game in 5 hours or whatever.
More effective than it gives me.
Yeah. So that's one of my like main, or like the thing that I connect with in my brain almost most directly with Metroid, was like seeing my teen babysitter beat it for me.
They were so cool back then. I'll tell you this. I understand. I'm 34. I was I would have been in exactly the same place. In my case, it was my older cousin who could beat the game, and I couldn't. And I just remember my jaw like must have hit the floor when I saw that.
Exactly.
And when I played the game by myself, it terrified me, but I couldn't stop playing. I was so scared of it. So, okay, so we got to rank this. There's so much to say, so much to do, but...
Fortunately, so there's about a billion podcasts that have talked about Super Metroid, so...
Yeah, but we got to be better. That's why.
Yeah, we got to rank higher than them.
Yeah, exactly.
I would throw, Mike... I guess my starting point is, you guys have all argued effectively for Lode Runner Online, The Mad Monk's Revenge. So I think that my pitch would be for below Lode Runner Online, The Mad Monk's Revenge, but above Devil May Cry.
I can live with that.
Okay. Shit. That's
Well, no, Satanga's going to say put it at number one, so it doesn't matter.
Hey,
it's already free.
I really do like Super Metroid. I mean, I wouldn't place it above Super Mario 64 or Doom, but it really is a hell of a game, and I do think we do have to give it its accolades. I mean, I think anyone ever given would probably put Super Metroid in their top 10 SNES games ever lists of how many the hell there are of those on the internet, so...
I will say really the game has probably influenced more developers than almost any game that exists. So in that regard, it is an incredibly important game.
I mean, probably most notably, it was likely a heavy influence for Koji Igarashi, and that's where we got the sort of second mm-hmm. wind of the Castlevania series with Symphony of the Night onwards.
Which are fun games, but do not do the heavy lifting that the Metroid game, the first three Metroid games did, or the first four Metroid games did.
Definitely.
You know, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I think that, Super Metroid being at that spot makes for a really, really strong top 10 list at this point. I know you guys have tens of thousands more games to get through, but right now that makes for a really solid top 10, I think.
Yeah, I'll say what Cal said puts it as Cal made a good argument for putting it, I would say, right below Doom and above Link to the Past, because it has influenced so many games that we play now. I'm a big Axiom Verge fan, for instance. Mm-hmm. That game can't exist without, and we're on the record now, BioShock 2. So, there are a game that makes other games better. There's no higher calling than that.
I mean, my own personal perspective is like Super Metroid is like really, really high up the list for me. But trying to also look at it from like a slightly broader perspective, I think that it is totally viable to argue that the original XCOM or that Link to the Past are like, quote unquote, better games or whatever. Anywhere under Doom and above Devil May Cry basically can make sense to me, I feel like, personally.
The reason I wouldn't push it personally any higher than you guys already know I don't love this game, is that the actual gameplay, like the core gameplay component, the most basic bare bony sort of playing it, I don't think it's a runaway success. I think it's pretty good. I think it's a solid game to play, but it just doesn't have that sort of super, like, really fun. I'm like, everything about, like, you explore, that's really fun. You get all these abilities, that's really fun.
Right.
But most of the actual game is I'm just jumping. I'm just kind of quickly pressing the shoot button occasionally. But I don't feel like I'm doing that much.
But that argument, I think, can be made for something like Metal Gear Solid as well, where Metal Gear Solid is like a really compelling and like important overall package, especially for when it was released. But like, especially the original game, a lot of those firefights and boss fights and like trying not to get seen by guys was not actually like fun or really super well.
I think it's tense, which I think Super Metroid loses a little bit compared to the original game, because you're a bit strong for most of Super Metroid.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying, like, looking at some of these games as more of an overall, like, for instance, I feel like you guys put Metal Gear Solid 3 Subsistence where you did, instead of just Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater, because Subsistence improves on so many aspects of the gameplay stuff, and I feel like the original Metal Gear Solid is super rough on those sides, but it's still a very, very like successful and important game. So I don't know.
All I'll say is not too many games you can point to say this made games after it better.
Yeah.
And that's
I'd be happy to put it above Lode Runner if you want to push it one up.
All right.
I'm pretty happy with where that goes, honestly.
Right under XCOM?
Yeah.
I can appreciate what this game has done for gaming in general, and I feel like that's a big reason why it should be where it will go.
Okay.
Plus we're going to probably get insults hurled at us by overzealous fans if we don't put Super Metroid extremely high. So between XCOM and Lode Runner Online, sounds good as any to me.
I feel like I failed if I don't get those insults.
Oh, personally. Well, then maybe we should rank it below Riven.
I'm being a jerk.
Steve, thanks for coming on the show. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you're working on now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. No, yeah. Um, 100%. Thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate, you know, the history that you guys preserve and really dig into on Hardcore Gaming 101. So thank you for having me on the show. And the game that I'm working on now is called Tacoma, and it's a first person story game that takes place on a space station, and you're digging through these 3D recordings of things that happened on the station before you arrived there and trying to reconstruct basically what led to the incident that caused the crew to be evacuated. You've been sent in to retrieve the AI from the station because the company that owns it wants it back. And so during that, you're kind of discovering the real events that happened in the lead up to your arrival. So that's going to be on PC and Xbox later this year. You can go to tacoma.game if you want to find out more about it. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Fulbright, F-U-L-L-E-R-I-G-H-T. I was literally tweeting pictures of my cat while we were recording today. So good content like that, as well as actual updates on our game, will be there if you want to check it out.
Great. Before you go, I just want to say the Fulbright logo, as a big fan of HyperCard style, like, you know, stippling effects, and big fan.
Awesome. We praised the hell out of those just last episode.
We did Deja Vu last episode.
Deja Vu. Phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I was just going to say that logo was done by a local graphic designer named Thomas Bradley. We were in a bar near our office, and we were talking about we wanted to redo our logo, and we were like, we want something kind of like this bar's logo, kind of like old-fashioned but fancy. And then we were like, we should Google who did this bar's logo. And then he just did our logo, so... Hey,
nice. I'm sorry for being somewhat quiet, but I just had a great time just listening to your thoughts and everything, and thank you very much for being willing to share those with us tonight.
By all means. Once again, thank you guys for having me on. It was a lot of fun to talk about these games.
And one more thing, sorry to keep piling on here, but everybody check out Steve's Recall blog on Tumblr, because I had no idea he was the guy behind that until about a week ago. I'm like, that's my favorite Tumblr ever, holy crap.
Oh, awesome.
So if you need some inspiration for cyberpunk, which is an aesthetic that I totally adore, give it a check. But
The man of many hats here.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It's
The URL is recall.me. It's R-E-K-A-L-L, like the company in Total Recall. I throw weird images, like kind of, futuristic cyberpunky images that I find up on there. It updates 4 or 5 times a night. Bookmark that guy if you want some visual inspiration.
Definitely.
That guy's great.
He really is. Good stuff. What can I say?
That's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to at Hoosier Dave Zero, at Resonance 333, and at KQAY2S on Twitter. Thank you guys for nominating those games, and thanks as well to those of you we didn't get to yet. We will be getting to you soon, and thanks to my lovely co-hosts and compatriots, and to our editor Jeff Rude, and our theme song composer Mateki, and our technical assistant and video editor Bobinator, and of course thanks to the support and feedback of listeners like you. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know I did. And you can help us out by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, which is fantastic. And you can help us out by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or I'll have to hire myself out as a mercenary, and I have a leadership score of almost 10. Until next week, keep keeping it real.